Cosmic Shed.
Hello, and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. It's very hot in the shed today. It's a heat wave here in the UK, certainly in Bristol. And as you can probably hear, I have timed a virus particularly well for a heat wave, so I can't even enjoy it. Today's episode is three interviews that Ty and I recorded at MCM Comic Con in London a couple of weeks ago. Warwick Davis of Star Wars, Eugene Simon of Game of Thrones and Genius, and Nichelle Nichols of Star Trek. So with those three people to hear from, and me with a virus, let's just get on with it. Here's Warwick Davis. This is recorded backstage at Comic-Con in London. It was at the Excel Centre. I don't know if you've ever been to the Excel Centre, but there's a corridor there, which is literally the whole length of the building. I don't know if there's more than one building, but this huge long building, and it is the most crazy long corridor you've ever seen. On that corridor, Ty and I met a huge number of people, including Donnie Yen. Unfortunately, he wouldn't do an interview for us, but we do have a load of interviews for you from Comic-Con, which we'll bring to you over the next few weeks. A part of this interview with Warwick Davis was recorded in the press room. That's quite a grand title, really, for what was essentially Warwick sitting with people from blogs, podcasters like ourselves, and, well, I suppose the BBC and Netflix were there as well, so the big guys were there. And we began by asking him what he had put into those roles that had made him famous.
Well, you know, it was me putting a furry suit on. And then acting like a curious 11-year-old does on a film set. That is exactly what happened. I put it all on and I started thinking, I did actually think this, what would this kind of primitive character do now? And straight away I clocked R2-D2. Because I thought, well, this is new. He's seen bits of the Empire kind of around on the planet. But this, to him, is like totally fun and different. So I went straight over to R2-D2 and started kind of peering at him. Then they go, oh, quick, get some shots of this. And that's kind of how I really, really played him. It was kind of basically me as an 11-year-old, crossed with my pet dog, who used to tilt his head like that whenever he heard a strange noise. And I thought, well, I'll do a bit of that. And I was able to get my own tongue through. So there is a bit of actually me in the Star Wars film. This actual tongue is Wicket's tongue. So it's a combination of a few things, but it's just kind of just played it. I've just played it real, and it happened to work quite well. Something like the Leprechaun character. That's kind of you sort of make it up as you go along a little bit, really. You do a particularly dodgy Irish accent, and then act like a complete nutter, and it sort of works. But it's always a pleasure, actually, to bring sort of characters and creatures to the screen, you know, especially, for example, in Harry Potter, some of these characters that people know and love from the literature. And then I feel a great responsibility to make sure that they appear on screen in the way that I feel the readers would have imagined them. You know, that's the trick when you adapt a book to the screen. So they're a little bit more tricky because I want to make sure I please everyone. But then there are other characters, you know, when you play characters in Star Wars and things where you're totally in control of them. I mean, they're written in the script and they're designed by wonderful artists, and then you get to wear these fabulous costumes and things. But then it becomes all about how you want to interpret what you've read and what you see in the shape of the character and how it looks to bring it to life, really. And then again, hope the audience like it. You know, as an actor, we kind of put ourselves out there and hope that what we're doing is what people are going to enjoy. And quite fortunate, most times I've got lucky in my career at the moment, but there's a lot of luck involved. Thank you.
Warwick, hello. Obviously, you're one of the very few actors, perhaps the only actor, who's been fortunate enough to work with all of our new Star Wars directors. So you've been with JJ, Gareth, and now Mr. Johnson. I'm curious, can you talk about each of those experiences and how you found them, particularly most recently?
I mean, all of the directors on the Star Wars films, you know, if you go back to Richard Marquand and George himself for episode one, and Gareth, they've all just brought their own sensibilities to it. Of course, you have to as the director, and that's why each of these individuals, not in the case of George, obviously, but that's why they're employed to kind of come and do these films, is because they bring something to the table themselves, a particular filmmaking style, a writing skill, whatever it might be. And I think that gives each of these films just a unique kind of a unique slant and individuality. But at the same time, they all still feel part of the same galaxy. Do you know what I mean? That we all know and love. Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, Richard Marquand, I do owe him a lot because it's him and David Tomlin, who was the first assistant director. Both of those guys kind of saw 11-year-old me as a background artist, you know, just filling in some bodies in the background and brought me to the fore and featured me, which was really lovely. I mean, you know, that's, again, another stroke of luck. But I was able to do things, you know, and interpret this character quite naturally in a way that was quite endearing and they enjoyed. And Richard, you know, kept just bringing me and putting me in shots and things like that. But Gareth, I was a big fan of Gareth Edwards. I loved his work on Monsters. I'm a particular fan of that film. And I'd actually been to a Q&A, an Empire magazine Q&A that he'd done and sat in the audience and asked questions. Little did I know at that point, one day he'd be directing a Star Wars movie. He didn't know that at that point, and I would also be in it. And it was really fun. With Gareth, though, you never quite know when the camera's rolling. He's one of these guys that just shoots stuff, and it's quite tricky when you're in a creature head. You're never quite sure of what is going to be in the movie and what isn't, and so it keeps you on your toes.
That's Warwick Davis backstage at the Comic-Con. And after that interview, Ty and I managed to catch up with Warwick literally just behind where he was taking photographs with fans. And just a reminder that Ty runs the Bristol Bad Film Club.
So Warwick, thank you very much for doing this with us.
Pleasure.
It's the 40th anniversary of Star Wars this week.
It is, so I hadn't noticed.
I mean, you're always at Star Wars Celebration. I mean, What's the franchise 40 years later? What does it still mean to you?
I mean, looking back, I mean, Star Wars has had such a huge impact on my life in so many ways. Initially, I was drawn to it as a 7-year-old boy. It was like nothing I'd seen before. And at that point, I didn't realise that it was going to become such a part of my life for the next 40 years and beyond. I mean, we're still making Star Wars now. It's incredible. It is incredible. But it's thanks to the fans, you know. The people like me who love Star Wars and get behind everything that comes out that's anything to do with Star Wars, you know.
And we saw you at Celebration. You paid tribute to Carrie Fisher, who, obviously, in Return of the Jedi, you shared a lot of scenes with her.
Yes, oh, absolutely. And I'm going to miss Carrie. I mean, I've found some photographs. We're moving house at the moment, and I found some photographs the other day and some little bits of video that I hadn't seen for a long time. And it's hard to realise that, you know, she's not going to just kind of walk on stage at a celebration and share those wonderful stories that she used to. I mean, some of my favourite times were on stage at Celebration with Carrie, just messing about and enjoying her wonderful sense of humour. And of course, we mustn't forget Kenny as well, who we also lost last year. Yeah. And he's somebody that I respected greatly for what he did as far as being a short actor and kind of how he managed to do a lot more than just be kind of hidden inside R2-D2. You know, there was so much more to Kenny as an entertainer. And Star Wars fans will always know and love him as R2. And R2 wouldn't have been R2-D2 without Kenny. You know, he brought such a lot of character into what essentially is a dustbin with a dome lid on it, you know. But that character, we all fell in love with it, didn't we?
Yeah. I have to ask, does it annoy you that Rogue One is considered the first Star Wars spin-off when everyone knows it's really Caravan of Courage and Battle for Endor?
Yeah. I hadn't really thought of it in that way, but I suppose we were doing it a long time ago, weren't we?
Yeah.
In a galaxy far, far away. I don't know what to say about that.
I mean, how did those films get announced? Because you had been in Return of the Jedi, and when George Lucas came to you and said, we're making two Ewok films, how did that happen?
I mean, he just said, we're going to make movies about the Ewoks. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that his daughter Amanda really fell in love with the Ewoks.
And,
you know, when you... Obviously, George is at home with her, and she's talking about Ewoks a lot. He's thinking, well, maybe we should actually tell a little story about these characters and what they get up to, you know, apart from the Battle of Endor we've just seen in Jedi, what are they about? So I guess that's where these ideas have come from. And, you know, and for George to kind of, it took a very bold step to make such a lavish production for television, basically. George is always paving the way in various areas of cinema and television. And, you know, then it followed on the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, you know. And now we see it in Netflix and everything, these very, very high quality TV series and films that are made for television now, you know.
So how long did they take to film, and what was it like for you? Because you were still 8 or 9 at the time?
Well, when we did Jedi, I was 11. Then the Caravan of Courage, I was about 13.
Okay.
And then I was 15 for Battle for Endor. And they took about 8 weeks over the summer holidays. So spent time in Northern California. Stayed just outside San Francisco in Marin County, which is where ILM used to be, and also filmed up on the ranch as well, and that kind of whole area. There's some redwoods there, so we didn't have to go back up to Northern California where Oregon is, where we shot Jedi. We shot it more locally.
Were you surprised when they killed Mace off for the second film? Because essentially they killed everyone for Battle of Endor, and it's just you and Sindel.
Yeah, but that's kind of essentially that's who it's about, isn't it? It's about Wicket at the end of the day. You don't need all these other characters. They're pretty superfluous to the plot. But, I mean, yeah, it's interesting, you know, you kill a hero. It's kind of what they did in Rogue One, isn't it? Just kind of everybody dies. Sorry, spoiler alert. It's kind of interesting the way you kind of have to deal with things sometimes. And, yeah, I think he was pretty gutted. Eric Walker was gutted to be killed off like that. You know.
And how about Wicket speaking English? Was that your idea? Was it just kind of like, we need more interaction with Sindel?
You need interaction. You can't have subtitles on it. I know what is essentially something for younger audiences. And, you know, hanging around with humans, he's going to pick a bit of language up. Not choice language, obviously, but just some of... And what's nice is that it shows that Ewoks are more intelligent than you probably take them for.
Yeah.
Initially, they can pick up language as well as, you know, kick Stormtrooper's ass.
And how grumpy was Wilford Brimley on set? Because there are stories that he did not like making the film.
Really? No, he was all right.
Really?
Yeah, he was all right. I mean, I think he kind of got a bit method, you know. The character he plays is a bit of a crotchety old geezer, isn't he?
Yeah.
And I think we kind of got a sense of that. That's a bit of Wilford himself. But he was fine, yeah, he was all right.
Do you think the films are still considered canon? Are we going to get a Senator Sindel in Episode 8?
I don't know. They're in and out of canon every time you read something. I don't know what's what. So who knows? I'm going to have to talk to Pablo sometime at the story group and ask him.
And obviously you're going to be in Episode 8 and Han Solo, and I'm sure you can't tell us what roles you're in. But how were they to film? Was it good fun?
8 was absolutely fabulous. All Star Wars movies are fabulous to make. I mean, there's no question about it. If you're a Star Wars fan like I am, just walking on one of the sets or seeing something you may or may not recognise from a previous film, all of that is just a joy. And we're still making Han Solo at the moment.
And I'm sure since Disney owned Lucasfilm, they also have the rights to Willow. Have you talked to Kathleen Kennedy about Willow too? And who would you like to get in as a queen, a Laura Dana?
You know, there's always a lot of talk about a Willow sequel, from be it Ron Howard chatting about it, be it, you know, Val Kilmer talking about it.
Yeah.
Just the other day he mentioned it again. I mean, I'd love to revisit. I think it'd be fun to see the characters when they're older, you know, because are they wiser?
Yeah.
You know, how has the Laura Dannen turned out? Did she, you know, did she rule properly? Did stuff go wrong? What's going on? And, I will chat to people about it. But there's always interest in seeing more of it, yeah.
Break out the old disappearing pig trick for good times.
Well, you know, if they can revisit Top Gun.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, why not? And a lot of 80s movies have been revisited, haven't they? You know, I wouldn't want to do a remake. I would want to do a sequel.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to do it. Like Episode 7 and Creed, their follows on rather than reboots. Finally, we're from Bristol, and you've done pantomime in Bristol several times.
Yes.
What are your thoughts of the city every time you visit?
Oh, it's nice. It's very friendly. Everyone's up for a good time. So whenever you appear on stage there, everyone's right behind the show. Your pavements are a little bit bumpy.
Sorry about
that. I will say the old cobbles.
We'll talk to the mayor. We'll
that's that very, very bumpy yeah. everywhere, but I do enjoy it there. Yeah, you've got a lovely shopping centre. Yeah. I don't like shopping that much, but you've got an Apple store down there, which is good.
Yeah.
So, what else? It rains a lot, though. That
it
is
does.
A problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I was there, I mean, my goodness me, we had a lot of rain.
And all the profits from our screening went to your charity, Little thank People. You're welcome. Well, thank the people that paid for tickets.
Yes.
How's the charity going? How do you continue to support Little People in the UK?
Well, Little People UK, yeah, we set up the charity to give advice, friendship and support to people with dwarfism, which is a condition I have and my wife has, my kids have, and we know a lot of people who have the condition as well. But we kind of have been fortunate to have great parents and been surrounded with positivity through our lives. But I know that's not the case for a lot of people. So we wanted to be there to help those guys and girls get the most out of life, you know. And, you know, we've learned the tricks of the trade and we can pass those things on to people. And, yeah, thanks so much for what you did and the screening. What a great idea. And thanks to everyone who came to support that, and you will have done a lot to help people, be it through our equipment loan scheme where we loan scooters or what have you to people who have mobility issues, whether it's, you know, having advice on a helpline and somebody to man that, you know, there's so many ways that the money is used.
Yeah.
But it's all put to very, very good use.
Fantastic.
Thank
Warwick,
you.
Thank you very much.
All right, cheers.
So of course when Ty gets time with Warwick Davis, the majority of the questions are about the Ewok spin-off films. But fortunately, we did manage to catch up with him again and get his thoughts on being in the new Star Wars films.
You know what, I'm just so thrilled that they asked me to be in these films once again, because for me as a Star Wars fan, it's hugely exciting just to walk onto the sets and to discover things. And yeah, I feel really privileged every time I walk in there to just see the things that they're creating, and some of them familiar, some of them unfamiliar. Yeah, it's an absolute delight. I mean, I think what I'm enjoying about the films that we're making now are the sense of so much of it is created now. You know, and as Kathy Kennedy said when she was just embarking on starting work on Episode 7, we're going to use all the tools in the toolbox, meaning not only are we going to use CGI, we're going to use models, we're going to use animatronics, puppeteers, we're going to build droids, we're going to do all of these things, and then they use a combination of techniques or solutions to form a particular sequence. It's a bit like a magician, you know. You never, you use a lot of different ways of doing a trick so that the whole thing is going to be complete and convincing. And so I think it's really lovely to see all of these somewhat older skills being utilised again. Whereas on Episode 1, that was a completely different film. Like, I'd never made a film like it before, where nothing existed, you know. I did a shot for that film where there was nothing except me and a blue screen. And I was having to imagine not only this creature that I was dealing with, but also the environment I was in. None of it existed. Whereas, you know, with films like Rogue One, that was a very immersive experience. All of it was there, you know, in a three-dimensional kind of 360-degree space. You looked all around you, there was stuff happening everywhere because you never knew what was going to be shot, because Gareth would shoot over there, then he'd whip the camera around here. So the crew are like diving behind, you know, things. And, you know, if you look carefully, you will see crew in the film. There'll be puppeteers with remote controls with hoods on and things, because you never knew quite where the camera was going.
So Nichelle Nichols is coming later in the podcast. But first, here's Eugene Simon, who it was a real pleasure to meet Eugene. He just the day before, he'd suffered a personal tragedy. And for him to still be at Comic-Con, still meeting the fans, and still want to spend time talking to Ty and I, well, I mean, thanks so much, Eugene. It really was a pleasure to meet you. Unfortunately, I don't have National Geographic Channel for personal reasons to do with Rupert Murdoch. But I did ask Eugene what the new series Genius is all about.
Genius is a 10-episode National Geographic's first scripted series, and it's to do with the personal and professional life of Albert Einstein. And it's set between sort of two universes, essentially. Him and his formative years, his sort of early 20s and kind of to mid-30s, played by Johnny Flynn. And it jumps to then into his later life, into his kind of early 40s, and right the way through until his death, played by Jeffrey Rush. And I play the role of his second son from his first marriage, who is Edward Einstein, and it's to do my role within it is a sort of exploration of his relationship with Albert and how they struggled to have a kind of a decent father-son relationship because of his rather difficult personal life.
Who's difficult personal?
Albert's difficult personal life. Well, both, in fact, really. I mean, it's a lot. There are two kind of aspects of my character related to one of them relates to Albert. The first one is the idea that Edward, and I think also his older brother Hans Albert, both felt very strongly their father had, in a very real sense, abandoned them when Mileva Maric and my mother and Albert Einstein split up. And the second aspect of it is to do with how, very unfortunately, Edward suffered from very heavily from schizophrenia, and it is to do with how he tried to psychoanalyze himself out of his condition because he worshipped Freud. So it's a fairly complex. It's a fairly complex world, but that's my story.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing because I mean, everyone seems to know the basics of Einstein. So his theory of relativity. He was a patent clerk for however many years, and then his physics breakthroughs. But it's the things about his personal life that we don't really know, apart from. Apparently, he allegedly had a brief relationship with Marilyn Monroe.
I've heard these myths, yeah, and I don't know whether to believe them as much as anyone else. Though.
She was married to Arthur Miller, so she likes a brain. If that's true.
Well, there we go.
Yeah. So, what research did you do once you got the part?
Well, there were two books I read straight away because I wanted to have as much just information as possible to put the pieces together. So, I read Walter Isaacson's biography on Einstein, and it is a wonderful book to read. And I think a lot of the content in this series is based off the information put together by Walter Isaacson. So, I read that, and I found what was very interesting for me is that I found these very intimate series of letters. Correspondence between Albert when he was in Berlin, he just moved to become a professor, and young Edward as he was growing up. And I was totally shocked and surprised at how, given the time in which we're talking about, which would have been something around 1912 or a little later than about 1920, the emotional content, like just how emotionally kind of liberal Edward was with telling Albert how he felt about what's going on with wanting to study psychiatry and how he fell in love, even when he was at medical school, he fell in love with his professor there, who was a 40-plus-year-old woman. Who he absolutely adored, and it was so detailed, and that was very unorthodox given the time. You don't do that in this kind of period in history. Yeah. It's a much more sort of how are you, father? You know, he lacked kind of emotional composure, and I found that very interesting about him. And the second thing I did was I read Carl Jung's Dreams, Memories and Reflections. I believe that's in the right order. And it's basically about his time working in Bogosli Insane Asylum, which is where Edward Einstein, from about the age of 20, spent on and off nearly the rest of his life until his 60s when he was diagnosed.
So light reading then.
Light reading. I know. Well, I'm desperately seeking to find the comedy in all of this, and I found a little snippet of it, which is that we're all going to talk about Albert Einstein's private life, but I was trying to understand his professional life because people ask me they would ask me, so what does E equals MC squared really mean? And how we go, oh God, it's like saying to be or not to be to someone and not having them ever read Hamlet, you can't say it. But I was like, okay, let me summarise it for you. It's E equals MC squared is to do with how gravity affects time and light. And that's it. That's the most summarised version I could ever get. Well, that's the most fun I've had trying to summarise that.
Does that happen often in American TV interviews? They go...
I think once they get to question 7, they go, what can we ask next? What's that thing we know? E equals MC. What does that mean? You go, what is the gender theory? Let me try and summarise this for you.
So have you kind of followed science as an interest?
I never studied it at school, but I mean, I always, I think it's very I mean, I hope I don't want to be too brash, but I think you have to be quite boring not to be interested in science on some level. As a point of interest, when I was in LA doing and New York doing press a while ago, I was very sweetly given by Toyota. I was driving a Toyota Mirai. It's a hydrogen powered car, and I just went to like she was like, "So, Eugene, what do you think of the dashboard?" And I go, "I don't get it, tell me about this car." And I was just completely nerded out. It runs. There's no battery process. It literally just takes gaseous hydrogen, releases it, puts it through a filament that has a chemical reaction, and then the produce of that is an immediate electric current, and the only thing that comes out of the exhaust pipe is water vapor.
Yeah.
So I was just drooling. I was like, "This is the future." Like, so yeah, no, science definitely interests me. I have an infatuation for it. Certainly.
Okay, and you're a role that other people know you for, of course, is from Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps we should talk about that a bit.
I think we should.
Your character in the early days was very different to the one that we saw later on. Did you have that arc in your mind when you started?
I have to tell you, I was quietly optimistic. I was hoping they would take some kind of leap. They would try to transform him in the way that I was surprised to see when I read the books.
Mm.
But what I was I remember it all very specifically, because, you know, the size of the role was something that I was really excited about, or rather the size of the show and how my character fitted into it. So when I read the books and I saw that Lancel returns as a member of the Sparrows and the Faith Militant, the depiction of him was that he was gaunt. I think Cersei says he has the kind of one foot in the coffin, long grey hair like that, you know, the gold mane has turned into sort of like, you know, bits of rather weak and failing grey, falling out grey hair. But so when they told me, well, actually what we're going to do is we're going to shave all your hair off, and we're going to eventually put the seven-pointed star on your forehead, and you're going to have a cudgel for a weapon, I kind of thought, well, this is fantastic, because, you know, we weren't in the habit of Game of Thrones, even though it's based on George R. R. Martin's books, of being guilty of total mimicry.
Yeah.
There was a kind of a new adaptation, and I think a more stoic and more fortuitous kind of embodiment of Lancel, which I actually quite liked, because I think that even in the books, even though he appears to be quite weak, underneath him is this sort of slab, this stone, an unbreakable stone of commitment to the to his religion, which I think you get in on both sides.
Do you know if the books are going to follow what the series does? Because you're still alive in the books, because the series has lapped the books. But did George R. R. Martin ever say, you know, you guys are doing what you're doing in the TV series, you've gone out in the biggest blaze of glory at the moment with like 15 other characters?
Yes.
Do you know if that's what's going to happen in the books? Do you know if Lancel was going to go another path?
Well, when I first got the role, very kindly, George emailed me almost straight away. I think even before I got sent through the first episode, I was given an email, and it gave me a rundown of what he was going to do. So I think that actually, to relate back to our last question, that was the trigger that made me go, right, I've got to look out for this. I've got to look out for this big change.
Yeah.
But he didn't, rightly so, give away what would be his future past. I think A Dance with Dragons wasn't out then, but he might have given me a little bit of a snippet of information. So that I don't know what's going to happen with Lancel. I would like to think, in a kind of slightly romantic way, he might go out dying. He might go out fighting for the faith. I was asked, what kind of alternative ending would you have liked for Lancel? I said, well, if we decided that, you know, the Faith Militant had sort of done their work in King's Landing and we're going to move on, let's spread it a bit more, and maybe he would die in some kind of holy war.
Because Lancel's fall comes from, he turns from a very naive horn dog, really,
yeah,
who's sleeping with his aunt, you know, a religious fundamentalist. How do you feel? I mean, it's in this day and age, religious fundamentalism is very much in the headlines.
Mm.
Do you think George R. R. Martin or the creators had that at the back of their mind when they were writing the books, writing the scripts, that it would become so prominent? Because, yeah, it's
it does seem fairly coincidental in some ways,
especially with how the last season ended.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, this did surprise me. I mean, when I think it was 2015 that season 5 came out, when Lancel returns as a Sparrow and then a member of the Faith Militant, and in no short blunt terms, that was the year essentially that ISIS rose.
Yeah.
And almost when the series aired was when we were kind of hearing a few words, these new words, these new references to, you know, kind of you know, armed religious extremists. I don't think there was. I don't honestly think there was any kind of desire to have to correlate what's happening in the world with that. I think really, the faith militant kind of embody a sort of a phase of Christian zealotry, probably around, you know, pre the Enlightenment or the kind of Counter Reformation. Really, I think that's what they are supposed to embody, a kind of inquisitorial attitude, because it's very specific. One thing I notice about the faith militant, unlike the Lord of Light, is that they're not magic.
Yeah.
They don't possess or seem to possess much magical ability, whereas the Lord of Light does, apparently, which would suggest he's probably more real. So in that sense, I think that it applies very specifically to a period in history. I don't know if it's, but obviously one can read into it today. It's hard not to.
Yeah.
I mean, we as people just keep repeating history, don't we? And we see it time and time again.
Yeah, I think we do. I think, well, more or less, in certain different ways, I think. But it certainly gives you a bit of insight into I think, what aspect in history I think George was sort of looking at.
You talk about the faith militant, and it's like, and we talk about militant atheists, and they're just a bit cross, aren't they? it's a very different thing.
Yeah, no, militant atheists, I guess they're kind of trying to really make a point that, you know, just everyone settle down. Let's just think about this for a second. I was actually watching, Cleek's been given Militant Atheist. I was watching a video with Christopher Hitchens literally about an hour ago. So there you go.
Yeah. What have you got coming up?
I also have an independent feature film that was shot with the Irish Board that's called The Lodgers. And okay. it's a 1920s post-World War I gothic horror set in the rural parts of Ireland. And I play a Irish war veteran returning from the Great War to his hometown, who more than unhappy with him for having fought for the British at the time. And it's about how he falls in love with a girl he knew from childhood, who has been this kind of the embodiment of mystery. So this girl that he never really kind of knew when he was growing up as a child before he went away to fight. And it's, for my character storyline, it's about falling in love, it's about his struggle, it's about dealing with the kind of pressure of living in a small-minded town that won't accept him. And that's now at Cannes, doing a private screening, and hopefully will be available very soon. So you're going to have to find me on Twitter to know more about that.
Yeah.
And what's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is @Eugene_Simon. And if you want to see a photo or two of it, you can go to Eugene Snaps, one word, on Instagram. So those are the two ways you're going to find out more.
Cool.
Yeah.
And final question, who do you think is going to end up on the Iron Throne?
I hope in lead mainstream characters, Tyrion. I'd like
sticking it to the Lannister lord.
Absolutely. Yeah, I might have had to grovel at his feet a couple of times, but I can tell you, he's still a good guy. Tyrion, as far as my favourite characters, Tyrion be on the Iron Throne, and then Varys, and I actually really like Theon Greyjoy, but neither of those two can fit on the Iron Throne. So yeah, Tyrion.
Great.
Well, thank you guys very much.
No problem. Thank you very much.
I appreciate
it.
Thanks so much. Nice to meet you, Andrew. Cheers.
Lovely to meet you too.
Nichelle needs no introduction, I'm sure, to everybody who listens to The Cosmic Shed. If you don't know who she is, just pause the podcast now and Google Nichelle Nichols, Star Trek. I'm glad that's sorted.
Nichelle, hi, it's an honour to meet you. My name's Ty.
Thank you. What's your name?
Ty.
Ty?
Yes.
Nice. Hi.
We're together.
This is my colleague Andrew. We do the shed. Uh-huh. Obviously, you've been such a pioneer in terms of Lieutenant Uhura being not just a woman, but a black woman in science fiction. We were wondering, of all the people who you've inspired, are you continually surprised that you've inspired so many people?
No, I'm not surprised, because so many people have come and spoke to me, and I'm in the public eye.
Yeah.
And so I respond accordingly. And it seems to work very well that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone from President Obama and Mae Jameson, the astronaut, yeah, love and adore you.
Yeah.
We were just wondering, in terms of diversity, like the new Star Trek series, the lead is a black woman, one of the captains is a Chinese woman. Are you happy about how diversity in science fiction continues to evolve?
Absolutely. I'm delighted as it evolves the way it's going. It should be, and it's more interesting.
One film role that I've always been intrigued by, because I grew up with you as Lieutenant Uhura,
uh-huh,
and then I saw a film, Truck Turner, where you played a brothel madam, and you were swearing at Isaac Hayes and everything.
Yeah.
That was one of the few blaxploitation films where you were in. I was wondering if that was a genre you deliberately stepped away from.
No, it was a good story, and it was a good part, and that's what you do.
Yeah, you're fantastic in it.
Thank you very much.
And, of course, I have to ask you the inevitable question about when you tried to quit Star Trek and then Martin Luther King Jr. persuaded you to stay.
Oh, boy. he said you can't and I couldn't.
And that was it.
Simple as that.
What's it like coming to events like this where you meet so many fans? Is it overwhelming?
I love it.
Exciting?
Or I'd be out of here.
Do you get many young girls coming up to you, citing you as still an inspiration to this day, and after 50 years of Star Trek?
A lot of young girls, a lot of middle-aged women, and a lot of older women. A lot in the male genre, too.
Lots of 33-year-old Asian men with beards and curly hair.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The odd 40-year-old white man as well. Yeah.
They're the cutest.
Well, I thank you. That's the best thing
there
I've heard today.
Go. Yeah.
Thank you so much for doing this. We didn't want to take up too much of your time, but it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very, very much. As you can see, we're getting out of here. It's been a pleasure being here because I really like people, and really nice people are Trekkers.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Michelle, it's been a pleasure.
It's my pleasure.
Well, there you go. I hope you've enjoyed these interviews from Comic-Con. We do have loads more, actually, so maybe we'll just put them out as and when. But we are going to do Westworld. No, we really are going to do Westworld. And thank you so much for listening.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.